Picture a father sitting down with his teenage daughter, trying to explain why some people sleep in mansions while others freeze on streets, why forests burn to boost GDP, why brilliant minds can't find work. Most of us would fumble through platitudes about working hard or that's just how things are. But what if you had to tell the truth, the whole uncomfortable truth, about how our world actually works? This is the challenge one father took on, not with charts and jargon, but through stories, myths, and radical honesty. Writing during Greece's financial collapse, having just resigned as finance minister after confronting Europe's most powerful bankers, he distilled decades of economic knowledge into letters his daughter could understand. The result isn't just accessible, it's transformative. Because once you see how the machinery of modern life actually operates, you can never unsee it. And that's exactly the point. Here's a question that sounds almost absurd. Why didn't Aboriginal Australians sail to England and colonize it instead of the reverse? The real answer lies in something far more mundane: surplus. Not moral superiority, not intelligence, but the ability to produce more food than you immediately need. In Australia's abundant climate, nature provided year-round. But in Eurasia, where seasons could mean the difference between survival and starvation, people had no choice. They planted, they stored, they created surplus. That surplus changed everything. It freed some people from food production entirely. They became craftsmen, soldiers, priests, rulers. The first writing systems weren't poetry or philosophy. They were accounting ledgers, tracking grain in Mesopotamian warehouses. Workers received shells marked with numbers representing grain owed to them. These tokens were simultaneously the first currency, the first debt records, and the first reason to need powerful authorities to guarantee them. The state was born from a granary receipt. As societies evolved, we confused two fundamentally different kinds of value: the joy of a sunset or helping a friend versus the price of things made to sell. When blood donation centers started paying people, donations dropped. Payment transformed a meaningful act into a mere transaction. Ancient societies understood this distinction. In Homer's epics, warriors like Achilles cared about honor and glory, not money. Today, we'd simply auction his weapons to the highest bidder. The transformation accelerated when European advances in shipbuilding triggered global trade. Merchants exchanged English wool for Chinese silk, returning vastly wealthier. Landowners evicted peasants to raise sheep, violent enclosures displacing over 70% of Britain's rural population. When merchant wealth combined with hordes of desperate unemployed and James Watt invented the steam engine, the Industrial Revolution exploded. This triumph of exchange value over experiential value brought liberation and horror. Serfdom ended, introducing new freedoms, but children worked chained to machines, pregnant women labored in mines, and slavery continued in colonies. We created the great contradiction: unimaginable wealth and unspeakable suffering coexisting, with inequalities persisting today. Christopher Marlowe's Dr. Faustus trades his soul for 24 years of power, a perfect metaphor for how debt transformed from neighborly favors into capitalism's engine. Traditional communities operated on informal solidarity. You helped harvest, they helped build. Market society turned this into legal contracts with interest payments. Under feudalism, the sequence was production, distribution, debt. Serfs produced, lords took their share, then sold surplus. But when land and labor became commodities, everything flipped: debt, production, distribution. Former serfs became entrepreneurs who borrowed up front to pay wages, buy seeds, and rent before selling anything. Like Faustus, they mortgaged their future for present resources. This transformed profit from luxury into survival necessity. If wool prices dropped or disaster struck, entrepreneurs faced ruin. Entrepreneurs are time travelers, grabbing future money and dragging it into the present. The banker controls who time travels and charges interest for the privilege. Here's what most misunderstand: bankers don't move money from savers to borrowers. They create money by typing numbers into accounts. It appears from nowhere. With no constraint on lending, only existing value, bankers maximize profits through endless keystrokes. Eventually, loans outpace the real economy. When businesses fail, workers lose jobs, banks hold unpayable debts. Depositors rush to withdraw savings, bank runs that exhaust reserves. Only the state can halt this spiral by preventing bank collapses through central bank loans, which also create money from thin air. Though logical to rescue banks but punish bankers after crashes, reality proves harsher. Politicians receive banker campaign contributions, creating mutual dependency. Bankers profit enormously during booms and get rescued during busts, denouncing government as a parasite during good times while demanding state bailouts during crashes. If unemployment stems from excessive wages, why can't workers simply lower their price until hired? When selling a house, dropping the price works. But labor markets operate differently. Even if all unemployed workers offered to work for pennies, fewer jobs would materialize, not more. Rousseau's stag hunt illustrates why. Hunters must coordinate to catch a stag, but each is tempted by easily caught hares. If one hunter doubts the others, the entire hunt collapses. Both optimism and pessimism become self-fulfilling in collective endeavors. Unlike physical goods, labor is valued only for what it produces. Entrepreneurs hire when confident customers will buy more products. Optimistic entrepreneurs hire workers who become customers themselves, creating a virtuous cycle. Pessimistic entrepreneurs don't hire, confirming their fears. Central banks lower interest rates during slumps to encourage borrowing, but entrepreneurs may interpret rate cuts as desperation signals. When falling wages and rates signal economic decline, entrepreneurs avoid hiring and borrowing, ensuring wages and rates stay low. The prophecy fulfills itself through our ability to predict others' actions and prioritize short-term self-preservation over collective benefit. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein captures our paradox with technology. We created mechanical slaves to free us, yet work furiously maintaining the machines meant to serve us. Karl Marx foresaw something like the Matrix as market society's logical endpoint. Competition forces entrepreneurs to adopt labor-saving technologies or perish. But successful automation triggers collapse. Machines replace workers, fewer people earn wages to buy products, prices collapse, entrepreneurs go bankrupt. These crises force human labor's comeback as hiring workers becomes cheaper than employing machines. The Luddites opposed not technology itself, but the social arrangement where so few owned the machines. After 2008, Bitcoin emerged as a digital dream beyond government control, but suffered serious flaws. Without state protection, users had no recourse against fraud. More critically, Bitcoin's fixed supply creates dangerous deflationary pressure. People hoard rather than spend, economic activity slows, crises become harder to resolve. To navigate between debt bubbles and deflationary stagnation, we must actively manage money supply. But such interventions affect people differently. Money can never be apolitical. The solution is democratizing money through one-person, one-vote control. Markets are presented as neutral, yet every outcome depends on political choices about property rights and money creation. The powerful want you to believe economics is like physics, governed by immutable laws beyond human control. This is ideology masquerading as science. Economics is politics by another name. Your vote in democracy counts the same as anyone's. Your market vote is determined by your wealth. When facing decisions about our collective future, which system should prevail? In The Matrix, Agent Smith compares humans to viruses, multiplying until resources vanish, then moving on. We've driven mass extinctions and destabilized the climate. How did creatures capable of philosophy become Earth's greatest threat? Market societies emerged as exchange values triumphed over experiential values. Consider a forest fire. Ecologically catastrophic, economically valuable through fuel consumption and reconstruction. Standing trees had zero exchange value. Market society structurally undervalues nature. Individual profit motives lead to collective destruction. Imagine 100 fishermen sharing a lake with 100 trout. Sustainable fishing means 2 fish daily per person. But competition drives longer hours to maximize personal catch. Soon, trout nearly disappear and everyone suffers. Each acted rationally given incentives, yet collectively behaved foolishly, what the ancient Greeks called idiotis. Indigenous peoples like Aboriginal Australians sustained themselves for tens of thousands of years while enjoying abundant free time. The difference? They hadn't commodified everything. Your generation will witness a clash. Democratize everything versus commodify everything. The powerful favor commodification because in democracy, each person gets one vote. In markets, votes are determined by wealth. We've become the virus Agent Smith described, but unlike actual viruses, we're conscious enough to change course. Imagine a computer reading your brainwaves, creating perfect virtual reality tailored to every desire, unlimited pleasure while androids care for your body. Would you enter forever? If you hesitate, you've rejected the idea that preference satisfaction is everything. John Stuart Mill explained, "It is better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied." Authentic happiness, what Greeks called eudaimonia, requires becoming, evolving, struggling. Character develops through conflict with a world that refuses all wishes. Market societies manufacture not just machines and wealth, but the desires needed for their perpetuation. Shopping malls exemplify this. Architecture, lighting, and music designed to numb critical thinking and manufacture wants you never had. Economics itself became the most potent ideological tool. As market societies emerged and science revealed religion as belief rather than fact, the ruling class needed a new narrative. Economics became this secular religion, with economists as its priesthood. Many economists claim their discipline is science like physics, using mathematical models to reveal economic laws. This is nonsense. Unlike physics, economics cannot be tested in controlled conditions. When economists insist they're scientists because they use mathematics, they're like astrologers claiming scientific status for using computers. Market society instills powerful illusions. Wealth reflects merit. Poverty reflects laziness. Current arrangements are natural. Freedom begins with understanding how the economy actually works, who does what to whom, who benefits and suffers, which narratives serve power versus truth. This understanding won't automatically fix problems, but ignorance guarantees continued domination. Once you see how the machinery operates, you can no longer pretend you didn't know. That's when real work begins, building a world where everyone flourishes.